This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kristin Scott Thomas, stars in the new movie, Sarah's Key. It's about a chapter in French history that the French are not proud of and is not well known. In 1942, during the Nazi occupation, the French police rounded up over 13,000 Jews and held them at an indoor cycling arena called the Vélodrome d'Hiver, or the Vel d'Hiv. From there, the Jews were sent to death camps. Sarah's Key alternates between the past and the present. Kristin Scott Thomas plays an American journalist in France working for an English language magazine. She's researching and writing an article about the roundup when she discovers the home she's about to move into was once occupied by a Jewish family that was deported in the roundup. Flashbacks tell that family's story. In this scene, Thomas is at an editorial meeting. When the editor suggests a story on the Vel d'Hiv roundup, the younger journalists at the meeting have no idea what he's talking about. Thomas explains.
On the 16th and 17th of July, 42, they arrested 13,000 Jews, mostly women and children. They took 8,000 of them, put them in the Vélodrome d'Hiver in inhuman conditions.
Imagine the Superdome in New Orleans, only a million times worse.
A million times worse. And then they send them to the camps.
Well, you seem to know your stuff.
Mm-hmm. I covered the 60th anniversary for Time magazine. I wanted to do a feature, and they gave me half a page, which is why you're going to give me 10 pages.
10 pages?
Mm-hmm.
No, Julie, I can't give you 10 pages.
Why not? Readers love history. Most of them haven't even heard of it. Look at these guys.
Apologies from the youth of today.
Yeah.
So if I understand correctly, it's an old indoor cycling track. It should be beautiful. Where is it?
Torn down 50 years ago.
Any photos?
None. That's the point. Over 10,000 people squeezed together for days. No beds, no toilets, barely any water. And not one image exists.
Well, there's one. There's a wide shot looking down over some buses outside. That's it.
It's weird. I mean, normally they were really good at that. They documented everything, the Nazis. That's what they were known for.
Mike. This was not the Germans, it was the French.
A scene from the new movie, Sarah's Key. Kristin Scott Thomas is an English actress who has lived in France since the age of 19. She's best known in America for her roles in Four Weddings and a Funeral, The English Patient, The Horse Whisperer, Gosford Park, and the French films I've Loved You So Long and Tell No One. Kristin Scott Thomas, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the roundup of the Jews in France in 1942 that Sarah's Key is focused around?
Well, as most people nowadays know, the French was an occupied country, occupied by the Nazis during the war. And the French police was clearly being run by the Gestapo, by the Nazis. And they received an order to round up 22,000 Jews in a period of 3 days. They were so desperate to fulfill this quota that they would go to schools, they went to hospitals, they went to orphanages, and they just got as many of the Jews as they possibly could, including small, small, small babies and children. And this was all done by French people.
Yes, and that's one of the things that's so shocking.
French citizens,
It's not the Nazis doing this. It's the Nazis ordering it. But it's the French who are fulfilling the order and rounding up the Jews and deporting them to camps.
And it's something that the French have been extremely wary of talking about and very, very, it's been certainly hidden away for a very, very long time.
How much did you know about this, like, horrible chapter in French history before making the film?
I think I knew a little bit more than most people. A lot of people don't know anything about this period. I don't know anything about this particular roundup or rafle, as it's called in French. I knew a bit because I had married, coming from England as a very young woman, I had married into a Jewish family and had been rapidly and quite shockingly educated as to a lot of the events. And at the same time, I'd been protecting myself because, you know, some of this information is just really quite horrific. And this had all been happening to members of my new family and... you know, it has a very strong resonance, all of that. And my mother-in-law, funnily enough, was herself hidden, a child during the war, and hidden in some distant part of France, away from Paris, and they'd been on the run, you know, they'd been hiding from moving from one place to another, as was my father-in-law, and they'd suffered the consequences of that and deep, deep, deep psychological scars. And she is now a psychoanalyst, and she belongs to a group of people who are very concerned to keep alive the memory of these children who were hidden during the war. And so they campaign for plaques to be put up on various buildings where children were taken during the war. So you'll walk down a Paris street and you'll see a plaque saying, on this day, 7 children were taken from this school. And then you walk 250 yards down the street, and on the other side you'll see, on this day, 3 families were taken from this building. And then you walk a bit further along, you come to a hospital, and it's quite shocking and a good reminder of how important it is to keep these things in our conscience.
You know, a difference between living in England and in France, and you've lived in both. You grew up in England and have lived in France since you were about 19?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, because France was occupied by the Nazis, there were collaborators in France, which is not something that happened in England. England was never occupied. England just fought against the Germans. Mm-hmm. So have you found yourself during your life in France sometimes wondering, who was a collaborator and who wasn't?
Oh, yes.
Who resisted and who turned in Jews?
Certainly. And I think that's something which is it's something that people say, you know, what were you doing during the war? It's still very much present, this idea of, and there's an expression that even kids will use if somebody, you know, is goody-two-shoes in school or sucks up to the teacher or whatever, you know, they'll be called a collabo. And,
for collaborator.
You know, so it's definitely remained in the air, you know, this idea of people who collaborated or didn't collaborate. And of course, now the people who are still alive and could be accused of that or have been accused of that are beginning to die. So during the time I've been living in France, there have been a great number of cases brought against people who are very, very old and probably about to die anyway, but accused of collaboration and accused of doing terrible atrocities during the war. There have been a number of those cases that I've, you know, seen go through the press.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kristin Scott Thomas, and she's now starring in the new film Sarah's Key, which is set in the present and in 1942 during the French roundup of the Jews during the Nazi occupation of France. You know, theoretically, I would have thought that moving to France would have narrowed the kinds of roles you would be accepted in, but it seems to have broadened it in a way. You've been in some really interesting French films, including Tell No One and I've Loved You So Long. How did you get your footing in France as an actress after you moved
well,
there?
Well, I moved there as a very young woman. I did my training, my acting training there, and I started work in the theatre. And then my first job was, in fact, on an American movie being shot in France. And then...
That was Prince's movie, Under the Cherry
Moon,
right?
Right? That's
how
right.
Did, yeah. How did Prince discover you?
Well, I'd been doing a play in a field. I'd been doing a Marguerite Duras play in a field in Burgundy. And then I got a call to go up for an audition to play one of the girlfriends in this film, you know, a girlfriend that has one line. And I dash up to Paris, put on my prettiest dress and go to this audition. And while I'm doing the audition, they see everybody sort of in a huddle behind the camera, a lot of muttering going on. And they said, would you like to audition for the lead? And it was a complete surprise. And I said, well, yes, I would like to audition for the lead, but I thought the lead had been cast. And the lead had, in fact, been cast, but they decided to uncast it and give it to me instead. So I was in shock, I think is the only word. And so it kind of took off from there. And then I followed that movie to its opening in LA and then hung around in LA for a bit and saw what was out there for me and really didn't like it. Came back to Europe and just started from scratch, really. But I had this experience and I had this unlikely and brilliant experience of working on a film directed and starring Prince, who was at the time the height of his powers and the height of his popularity.
So I just need to ask you about working with Prince. He's such a great performer, but he seems so inscrutable. Was it easy to talk with him? Did he communicate?
yes, he does. Of course he communicated, and the more time we spent together, working on this project, the more we got to know each other and the less shy and inscrutable, as you say, he became. And then suddenly the curtains would come down, the blackout, and you wouldn't be allowed to talk to him because he was creating or doing his music. And that, with somebody like him, there's always a million people, a sort of barrage of a million people around him, stopping you from becoming too friendly or whatever it is. I think everyone's slightly afraid that you're going to be their favourite and they're going to get downgraded. So I think that was happening a lot. We were so young when I think back now. It's just crazy. He was 24 and I was 23 or something. And all these people sort of running around him, no one running around me, but people running around making sure, everything was all right, cups of tea, cups of coffee, this, that, and whether the carpet under his feet was fluffy enough and, all this kind of thing. It just seems completely mad. And it sort of put me off that whole showbiz thing. It sort of put me off stardom. And in fact, one of the producers came into my dressing room just before we wrapped the movie. They came in to talk about promotion and they said, "Now, Kristen, very simple question. Do you want to be a star or not?" And I really had to think about it. And at the end of it, I said, "Well, actually, I don't really want to be a star. Thank you very much. I want to be an actress. I don't really want to be a star." And which is good, because I never really was.
did you actually have a choice? Like, yes, I want to be a star, so make me a star.
Well, I think what they meant by that was, would I be game to go and do, the massive amounts of promotion? Would I be game to go and be photographed in this, that, and the other? And, did I want to get out there, basically, into the media? And the answer was no. So I just sort of stuck to my guns, and I've been plodding through my career, and I've had times which have been extremely exciting, creatively and, artistically. And I have had other times when I've been tearing my hair out thinking, when am I getting another job that it's actually worth me getting out of bed for, because it just isn't, it's just the same old thing, and it's really, really dull. And for the past 6-7 years, I've just been doing things that I've really loved and really enjoyed, a mixture of French film, small roles in English language films that have been quirky, and great British theatre, which is what I'm doing at the moment, which I'm absolutely thrilled about.
Let me tell you, I see a lot of movies, and I'm so often frustrated. I mean, there's so many movies that aren't very good, and I guess you must feel that too as an actress, that there's a lot of stuff out there that you don't feel
some
worth
of it
the time.
I read, some of it I read, and I think, why? What is the point of spending so much money to do this
and time
when other projects that I've read can't get greenlit because they haven't got a 24-year-old star in it, or they haven't got, or it can't be shown on primetime TV at 8 o'clock because whatever. Pictures that I think are beautiful have actual, who are poetic, who are inspirational, these movies that have a real strength to them, a real force to them, sort of life force to them, won't get made because they're not general enough or something. Which is why working in France is, for me, the option I prefer, simply because the stakes are so much lower. Sure, it still costs money to make a movie, because no one's expecting, massive windfalls, and no one is, they're not compete, the competition isn't so stiff because it's a French language market. So if it escapes the French language market and goes onto foreign soil, as Sarah's Key has done, as I've Loved You So Long has done, then that's a bonus, and it's great. We're really, really happy. But basically, if the film works in France, it's already great. We're really happy.
You end up having a very passionate affair with the Ralph Fiennes character in this film, and it's a very romantic, very tragic movie. What impact did it have on your career to be the beautiful, romantic leading lady?
Well, it made a change from being the sort of the one that never gets the guy, the unhappy one lurking in the background. It was great fun playing this sort of radiant woman, the sort of woman that everybody wants to be, you know, loved, beautiful, looking great, sandy, and with a love of poetry and love of nature and this incredibly handsome, rugged, grumpy count, passionately in love with her. I mean, that's sort of what everybody wants, isn't it? And I was able to do that for 6 weeks or something.
So were you thought of for a lot of other romantic leads after that?
Oh, definitely. Yes, every time there was a desert, I'd get the call. And it's sort of aristocratic, sharp objects of desire. That's what I was categorized as at one point, I think.
And is that what you wanted?
No, I wanted variety. I think that's what we all, actresses and actors, really, really want, is variety. I find that the moment I make a film which involves a lot of soul-searching or deep emotion, I'll invariably pick a very silly comedy to do afterwards, which I will then kick myself for doing. But that's usually what happens.
If you don't mind my bringing this up, I know your father was killed in a flying accident. He was in the Royal Navy. And 6 years later, your stepfather, also a pilot in the Royal Navy, was killed in a flying accident. I can hardly imagine how traumatic that must have been. What sense did it give you of the fragility of life to have two fathers killed in the same way?
Well, that question requires a lot of answer. and I can tell you that it has certainly been part of that, so deeply part of who I am, that to describe what sense it gives to my life would, you know, it has taken me years on a couch. But it certainly is.
You're talking about therapy?
It's just part of me. Yeah, it's just part of me. That's just the way it is. You know, some people grow up with their parents yelling at each other. Some people grow up with their parents, one of their parents seriously ill, and another can have a perfect, you know, seemingly perfect childhood. It's just what you're given, what you're lot, and you just get on with it. Sounds very British, all that, doesn't it?
You know, it's funny. I don't think I'm the first person to point this out, but in The English Patient, you die in a flying crash, in a plane crash.
Yes. But lots of people picked up on that when the film came out. I can't remember what my answers were to all the questions, but now it seems, I mean, so it was a long time ago, The English Patient, what, 12, 15 years ago? And I think that probably that was one of the reasons I really wanted to play that part, because I did feel very emotionally linked to the events that go on in the film. And that, you know, that the idea that the man will come back for you, all this kind of thing. I mean, you don't have to be a therapist to understand that. You know, it's very, very easy, simple. And those were the things that drew me to it, to be rescued by a man. When you're at death's door after an aeroplane crash, you know, that's simple.
Can I get your take on the Rupert Murdoch tabloid scandal? You know, you're British. I'm sure you have a lot of friends who mostly act in England and who have been hounded by the tabloids. Certainly, you know, you Grant, because you starred with him in Four Weddings and a Funeral, and he had his problems with the tabloids. Yeah. So your quick take on
that? Well, he's been fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen him come out of the starting blocks and just be amazing on television and being really articulate and clever. And I'm really happy to see he's doing all this.
Have you ever been victimized at the moment, by the tabloids?
Yeah, a couple of times. But I mean, you know, you sort of, it's very, very, very unpleasant. It's a horrible feeling of being tracked like that, of being hunted. It's a horrible feeling of the damage, the collateral damage that is done, because somebody may say something about you, which you can sort of brush off, but then your children hear it too. And then, you know, I've had to, you know, mop lots of faces with things that people have said because they'd heard that their parents had read it in the paper, and things that have basically been totally untrue, as well as things that have been true, but made things that are true and perfectly okay in everyday life, but when written in a certain, described in a certain way, become, you know, sort of unworthy and unpleasant and just miserable. So we'll see what goes on. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating, all this, that what's going on at the moment. Quite extraordinary.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Kristin Scott Thomas stars in the new film Sarah's Key. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The characters in the new novel, The Devil All the Time, are given to extremes. There's a preacher who dumps a jar of spiders on his head during a sermon to demonstrate how he lost his fear of spiders. There's two serial killers. At the center of the story is a father who's obsessed with beating the devil, his wife who is dying of cancer, and their son who becomes an orphan. The story begins in the small town of Knockemstiff, which is where the author, Donald Ray Pollock, grew up. He didn't become a writer until he put in over 30 years at the local paper mill and got sober. But once he did start writing, he was noticed. After the publication of his first book, a collection of short stories called Knockemstiff, he received the 2009 Penn Robert W. Bingham Fellowship. Describing Pollock's new novel in the New York Times, Charles McGrath wrote, "Its violence and religious occupations venture into Flannery O'Connor territory." Donald Ray Pollock, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a reading from your new book, The Devil All the Time. It's about the second paragraph from the prologue, so would you just set it up for us?
Well, what we have here is young boy. His name is Arvin Eugene Russell, and he's following behind his father, Willard, and they're in a place called Knockemstiff. And they're going to Willard's prayer log. He has a log in the woods where he, wants to communicate with God. And so this is where they are. It's, early in the morning, and they're have finally reached this log. Willard eased himself down on the high side of the log and motioned for his son to kneel beside him in the dead, soggy leaves. Unless he had whiskey running through his veins, Willard came to the clearing every morning and evening to talk to God. Arvin didn't know which was worse, the drinking or the praying. As far back as he could remember, it seemed that his father had fought the devil all the time. Arvin shivered a little with the damp, pulled his coat tighter. He wished he were still in bed. Even school, with all its miseries, was better than this, but it was a Saturday and there was no way to get around it. Through the mostly bare trees beyond the cross, Arvin could see wisps of smoke rising from a few chimneys half a mile away. 400 or so people lived in Knockemstiff in 1957, nearly all of them connected by blood through one God-forsaken calamity or another, be it lust or necessity or just plain ignorance. Along with the tar-papered shacks and cinder-block houses, the holler included two general stores and a Church of Christ and Christian Union and a joint known throughout the township as the Bull Pen. 3 days before, he'd come home with another black eye. "I don't condone no fighting just for the hell of it, but sometimes you're just too easygoing," Willard had told him that evening. "Them boys might be bigger than you, but the next time one of them starts his stuff, I want you to finish it." Willard was standing on the porch changing out of his work clothes. He handed Arvin the brown pants, stiff with dried blood and grease. He worked in a slaughterhouse in Greenfield, and that day 1,600 hogs had been butchered, a new record for R.J. Carroll Meatpacking. Though the boy didn't know yet what he wanted to do when he grew up, he was pretty sure he didn't want to kill pigs for a living.
That's Donald Ray Pollock reading from his new novel, The Devil All the Time. Now, Willard the father is a man who doesn't know from moderation. The kind of religion he practices is very extreme. He's also very extreme in the kind of violence that he provokes. Would you describe the prayer log, which is the location of the opening scene that you read, the prayer log that the father uses?
Well, it's just a log that's in the woods, at least a few hundred yards from their house. And Willard is not comfortable praying in a regular church. He likes to be out, in nature. So the prayer log is sort of his church. I actually got that idea from when I was growing up out in Knockemstiff. There was an old man who lived pretty much on top of the hill behind our house. And he was a very religious man, a very good man. And every once in a while, he would go into the woods and pray. And if the wind was just right, you could hear him from our house. And, you know, now he wasn't anything like Willard, of course. But that was actually where I got that idea from for the prayer log.
But the idea of the prayer log is so much more extreme than what you've just described, because the father uses the prayer log to make blood sacrifices in the hopes that those blood sacrifices will save the life of his wife who is dying from cancer. So how did you think of that? I mean, not I know there's an ancient history of blood sacrifices, but to have that in a contemporary novel.
Well, I don't know. You know, a lot of this stuff is hard for me to explain as far as where I got this from or that from, because, you know, I'm not the most, I'm probably the least cerebral writer you're ever going to meet. You know, my stuff comes about by just typing, and I just keep working at it. And, you know, I wanted to set it up where Arvin loses both of his parents. So his mother, you know, of course, you know, I decided she had to get sick. And then, you know, with Willard being religious, or, you know, coming from a religious background, it just happened, you know, that the blood sacrifices came about.
You know, in the reading that you did, the father tells the son that the next time somebody beats him up, the son has to fight back. And that seems to be a recurring theme, like in the opening story of your collection of short stories. The collection is called Knock 'em Stiff. The opening sentence reads, "My father showed me how to hurt a man one August night at the Torch Drive-In when I was 7 years old. It was the only thing he was ever any good at." You certainly seem interested in the idea of a father kind of indoctrinating a son on the need to fight back and then egging him on to do it, even when it's inappropriate. So is this a story that played out in your life?
Well, not so much in my life. I mean, as far as my dad really didn't push me to fight or anything like that. But, you know, when I was growing up, my father and I had a very uneasy relationship. You've got to understand, my dad was born in 1930. He's still alive, you know, he's 80 years old and he's still kicking. But he was born in 1930, grew up in the Depression. He went to the eighth grade. He was working on the railroad by the time he was 16, and, you know, then he was in the Navy. And my dad is a very tough, hard man, very strong man. And in contrast to that, my mother is this very shy, kind, small-boned woman. And either fortunately or unfortunately for me, I took after my mother. And I believe when I was a kid, my dad was maybe disappointed in me for not taking after him more. So, you know, that's where I guess part of that comes from. And part of it also comes from, you know, I was lived in Knock 'em Stiff. That's where I grew up. And I saw a lot of other fathers who were, you know, drinkers and hellraisers, and they didn't treat their families very well. You know, maybe they went and worked for a while until they got enough money to, you know, go on another binge or whatever, and pretty much left the family to take care of themselves. So, yeah, fathers have a pretty rough time in my work. you know, it's just, you know, I'm a father. You know, I have a daughter who's about 30 years old now, and I have always felt that I wasn't as good as I could have been. Her mother and I were divorced when she was very young. She was like a year old, and I wasn't around her that much. And that's probably, you know, the best explanation I can give for why I treat fathers like I do in my work.
Were you bullied in school? You said you took after your mother, who wouldn't hurt a fly.
So, right.
And if you were bullied, would you fight back? Did you know how to?
Actually, I wasn't bullied in school. I never really had any problems with that. And yeah, I mean, I would fight back if I had to, but that situation, you know, didn't come about very much. Probably, you know, just no more than any other normal kid, you know, might face that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't really interested in working on cars or farming or anything like that. And I was more of a, I won't call myself a bookworm because we really didn't have that many books. But, you know, I like to read and watch old movies and draw and stuff like that. And my dad just, you know, he's a very practical man. I mean, even today, you know, his idea of success is owning your own farm or starting your own business or something like that. And I know that he probably looks on what I'm doing now as a pretty useless way to spend your life, you know, trying to write books.
Would you describe what the town of Knockemstiff was like when you were growing up?
Well, when I was growing up there, it was, you know,
first,
really
locate it for us.
Okay. Well, Knockemstiff is about 13 miles west of Chillicothe, Ohio, which is, you know, southern Ohio. It was its own little place. You know, there wasn't much else around there, but it was a community. There were three small general stores and a bar and a church and probably 450, 500 people. Now, I probably was related to at least half those people.
So did you find this nurturing, being in a town where half the people in it were related to you or incredibly claustrophobic?
I think when I was a kid, it was claustrophobic for me. You know, I was one of those kids, I was always unsatisfied. I always wanted to be somebody else and somewhere else. And so from a very early age, you know, I was thinking about escaping from the holler. I just thought that I'd rather be somewhere else.
Well, you are somewhere else, but where you are is in Chillicothe, which is about 13 miles away. So, like, you got out, but you didn't go very far.
I really didn't get out. I mean, that's the weird contradiction of that whole thing. You know, I wanted to escape, and then when I finally got my chance or whatever, I chose to stay. I'm out at Knockemstiff at least once a week, even today.
What? Are your parents still there?
I go to visit my parents. Yeah, they're both still alive. You know, I have a brother and two sisters, and they all live fairly close to there, and so I think, though, as far as escape goes, what happened with me was I quit high school when I was 17, and I went to work in a meatpacking plant, much like Willard worked in. And then when I was 18, I moved to Florida. You know, I was going to get away by moving to Florida. And I was down there working a job in a nursery, and I wasn't making much money or anything. And I'd only been there a few months, and my dad called and said, "Hey, I can get you a job at the paper mill if you come back up here." So I chose to come back. You know, the paper mill was calling. It was, you know, union job and great benefits. And I knew, you know, for a high school dropout, that was probably going to be the best job I ever got.
You had that job for a long time. How many years did you work at the paper mill?
I was there 32 years.
And you didn't start writing till you were around 50? Or is 50...
Well, I'm 56 now, and I started writing when I was 45.
Okay. So how come it took so long? Did you know, when you weren't writing, did you know that you had that in you?
Well, you know, I'd always been a big reader, as I said, and I love books. And I think maybe in the back of my mind, you know, I always thought writing would be a great way to get by in the world. And, you know, of course, I was very naive about it. The principal reasons for me, you know, as far as being a writer were, one, you were your own boss. Two, you could do it anywhere. And three, you made lots of money.
Ha!
And so it wasn't until I actually began writing that I found out that that wasn't really true. But I think, you know, it was sort of like maybe a fantasy that, you know, was in the back of my mind for a long time. I had a problem with drinking and for a number of years. And, You know, it was one of those fantasies that, you know, when you got half loaded and, you know, you started daydreaming or whatever, it was one of those things that you thought about, or I thought about. But it wasn't really, you know, I went to school when I was in my 30s. I went to college. I went to Ohio University, and I ended up with a degree in English. And, you know, even while I was there, though, I wasn't thinking about being a writer. I never took any writing workshops or anything like that. But then finally, when I was 45, my dad retired from the paper mill. And there was just something about watching him retire and go home. And, you know, that was, you know, pretty much the end of his career. And it really bothered me. And I just decided I had to try something else, you know, some other way to spend the rest of my life.
So when you decided you wanted to learn how to write, what did that mean?
Well, for me, I didn't actually know what it meant. And, you know, I didn't know any writers or anything. And for a while, I just sort of scribbled and struggled. And then I'd read an interview with a writer, and I can't recall her name now. I know it was a lady. But she talked about typing out other people's stories as a means of maybe getting closer to them or just learning how to put a story together. And so I started doing that.
Whose stories did you type out?
I typed out a lot of different stories. I was typing out a story at least once a week, and that went on for about a year and a half. So there are quite a few stories. John Cheever, Hemingway, Flannery O'Connor, Richard Yates, Dennis Johnson, you know, the list just goes on and on. If it was a story that I really liked and it wasn't overly long, I'd type it out. And then I'd carry it around with me for a week and, you know, look it over and, you know, jot notes on it and stuff like that. And then I'd throw it away and do another one. Typing a story out just was a much better way for me to see how, you know, a person puts dialogue together or, you know, moves from one scene to the next, that sort of thing.
Was it hard for you to find your subject matter as a writer?
Well, when I first started trying to learn how to write, you know, as I said, like maybe I would copy out a John Cheever story. So then I would try to write my own story about some East Coast suburbanite, you know, having an affair or something like that. Or maybe I'd write about a, you know, I'd read a Andre Debuse story, and then I'd write about a Catholic priest. And so I did that for maybe 2 years or so, and it just wasn't working at all for me. And then finally, maybe at about 2.5 years, I wrote a story that's included in the book Knock 'Em Stiff called Back Teen. And it's a very short story, and it's about these two losers sitting in a donut shop. And that was the first thing that I had written that I thought wasn't too bad. And so then I increasingly just started focusing on, you know, the people that I knew about instead of nurses, lawyers, that sort of thing that I had absolutely no idea how to write about.
There's a passage in your new novel that's about a bus driver, and the bus driver's father had once gotten a certificate from the railroad for not missing a single day of work in 20 years. And the bus driver's mother always held this up as like what you could do if you really, you know, were a striver and tried to accomplish something. And when the bus driver's father died, the bus driver hoped that that certificate would be buried with his father so he didn't have to look at it anymore. But instead, his mother just, like, put it on the wall to display it in the living room.
Yes.
And then the bus driver thinks, it wore on you after a while, other people's accomplishments. I love that sentence. Did you ever feel that way? I mean, the accomplishment here seems so relatively small, like a good attendance record, and not to knock that, but for that to be like, you know, the zenith of somebody's life is, but,
right.
Yeah. But did you ever feel that way, that it wore on you other people's accomplishments?
I don't think that I paid so much attention to other people's successes or whatever, but I know that I was aware You know, by the time I was 32 or so, and I'd been working at the mill for about 14 years by then, and I knew that all the guys that I had come in with, you know, got hired about the same time as me, or guys even much later than that. You know, they owned their own home, and maybe they owned a boat, and they had two or three vehicles, and they were married and had kids, and on and on and on. You know, in contrast to them, I'd been divorced twice. I'd filed bankruptcy. When I got sober, I was living in this little, very small apartment above this garage. It was about the size of a motel room, and I'd been living there for about 4 or 5 years. I owned a black and white TV that my sister had given me, and I had this old 76 Chevy that had the whole side of it smashed in. And that was it. You know, for 14 years of working there, that's what I had. And so, you know, there was that sense, I guess, of me just being a failure. It wasn't really that. I wasn't jealous of those people or anything like that. I mean, I had enough sense to know that, you know, where I had ended up was my own fault. But there was always that idea in the back of my head that I could have done more. You know, I could have maybe went to college or something. You know, I'm sure, you know, if I'd wanted to go to school when I was 18, my dad would have tried to help me. And, you know, that's not the route that I chose, though.
How has your life changed now as a published writer? You have a collection of short stories. You have a new novel. You got a $35,000 cash prize, the Penn Robert Bingham Award.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what's different about your life?
Well, I have a lot more time to just sit on the porch and, you know, smoke and
Daydream and think it's a legitimate part of your work.
Yeah, well, at least that's what I tell my wife anyway.
Yeah.
But my life hasn't really changed that much. I mean, I get a lot more emails now, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, I still live in the same house. I still pretty much, you know, my daily routine is pretty much the same. You know, it's never changed. Well, you know, since I quit the mill and went to grad school, I really can't say that it's changed that much. It's a good life, and I'm thrilled that, you know, I've got a publisher and, you know, had at least a little bit of success. You know, I know a lot of writers out there who are much better than I am and would probably give their left arm to be sitting, you know, where I'm sitting today.
Has your self-image changed? Because, you know, for years you thought of yourself as this big failure. You worked at the paper mill, paid no attention to the job, just kind of got it done, punched the clock, watched your friends be much more successful than you were, at least in their marriages and their homes. So, you know, you felt like a failure. You had had an alcohol problem for a while until you were 32. And now you're a pretty successful writer. I'm not going to say you're a household name, but, you know, you have two books published. You get good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
So has your self-image changed?
Yeah, it has. It's changed a lot. But that started happening even long before I started trying to learn how to write. I mean, once I got sober and once I went to a lot of meetings and I tried to work the program and get rid of a lot of baggage and, you know, straighten out the past and all that. And once I started just doing those things and also becoming a more just responsible worker, you know, at the paper mill, once I started doing those things, my attitude towards myself and towards other people even started changing. You know, I can remember when I was told my wife I was going to learn how to write short stories, and I said, if I can just write one decent short story, I'll be satisfied. And, you know, even though, you know, I've been able to do more than that, I think that I would have probably been okay, you know, with everything if it had just been that one story. I don't have that unsatisfied feeling going on in my head anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, Donald Ray Pollack, thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, Terry, I appreciate it. You've made my day.
Donald Ray Pollack is the author of the new novel, The Devil All the Time. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.